Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Cognitive Recalibration Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Shravan. We've got Torrin here with us.
Ready to party.
Yeah, you're
very... I could hear that, but I could hear it through your headphones. It was bleeding a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, good that you heard it, because then you knew when to talk.
Did I?
Yeah. Well, it sounded like you did.
No. I was, no.
Anyway, as promised, we're going to be talking about Lord of the Rings, starting with, obviously, Fellowship of the Ring today. This is in preparation for the Rings of Power, which is starting in about a week now, I think. Exactly a week, right? I think it's next Friday that's starting. But if we're going to talk about Lord of the Rings, we couldn't do it justice without a little bit of help. So we've got Bhaskar Cherukuri and Bhargava Cherukuri joining us. We actually did a combined watch session last weekend for the extended version of Fellowship of the Rings. So we're going to be reviewing that version today. So welcome, guys.
Hey, howdy.
Thank you. Hello.
We had to get you guys in because you've actually read Lord of the Rings.
I haven't finished it yet.
Okay. Well, I know you've read Bhargava.
No surprises that this guy hasn't finished it. It's only been out for 30 years.
Remember when we were younger and Bhaskar used to read books over like 2 to 3 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Decades,
yeah. That's still the same. Yeah.
There was... I can't remember which Harry Potter it was, but one of the Harry Potter movies, you were reading the book like as we were walking into the theater.
Oh, yeah. As in, I was rereading it. It was Goblet of Fire. I actually brought it into the theater.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. That was funny.
But yeah, Lord of the Rings, I haven't read it, and you haven't read it.
Nah.
Yeah.
I've read a little bit of The Hobbit.
Mm. Yes. I have read The Hobbit, but I haven't read Lord of the Rings. I'm planning on getting the audiobook, actually.
I remember you guys used to have the book, all three of them.
Yeah.
At your house. Yeah.
Yeah. We had the combined one.
Yeah.
The audiobooks are read by Andy Serkis, actually.
Oh, cool.
The most recent ones.
Yeah, yes. The one on Audible. If you want to get into it, this would actually be a prime slot for an Audible sponsorship, but we don't have one. So
okay, let's do it anyway, and then we'll get it. Yeah, we'll blackmail them.
We've done a sponsorship for you without your knowledge. So as usual, we'll do a bit of background. Should we do a non-spoiler review for this? It's been out for almost 20 years.
More than 20 years.
No need for non-spoilers.
Okay, so we'll
if
jump.
If you haven't seen Lord of the Rings yet, you're never going to watch it. So
That's a fair analysis.
Yeah. So
I reckon if you haven't seen it yet because you're intimidated by it, hopefully this will dissuade any kind of apprehension you have.
Yeah. So we'll do like high level thoughts very briefly, and then we'll do full spoilers for the rest of the review. Mm. And I've got a bit of trivia. So the trivia section for this particular movie, I'm pretty sure it's the same for the other two on IMDb, is just ridiculously long. Like, we're not going to get through all of it. That's so insane. I've just picked out some highlights, and we can. And I know you guys have watch the appendices and stuff. So if there's anything you guys want to add, you can do that as well. All right, quick background. So obviously it's directed by Peter Jackson. He spent a long time preparing for this. You were telling me just earlier, he spent 2 years actually preparing the script before filming.
Yeah, and storyboarding and all the prep work was done well before even the first shot was taken.
Yes, yeah. And they started shooting in 1999. And this movie came out in December of 2001. But they shot all three movies at once. It's actually got the equal record for the total number of days shot for a film.
Yeah, was it 2 years or something?
It's like 267 days or 260 odd days that they shot for. And it equals, do you want to guess what the other movie is that shot for the same amount of time?
Was it Cars 1?
Same amount.
Cars 1.
Cars 1? Surely. Well, they didn't shoot anything.
Cars 1. Totally CGI film.
Is it recent?
No, it's pretty old. 70s, I think.
Oh, Apocalypse Now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that...
That was horrible, horrible conditions that they shot that in. Yeah.
Insane. So equal longest in terms of shooting, except that this is three movies and that was one movie. So anyway, in terms of the box office, so firstly budget. So budget was $93 million, which, I mean, it's not adjusted for inflation, but it is still pretty low considering the output that they've got. Like most movies these days are,
She did get that. Could you try again?
Siri didn't get it. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand.
That's enough for you.
Yeah, so most movies these days, blockbusters are about $200 million. So it is not as expensive as it looks. Box office-wise, do you want to guess how much it made box office-wise?
I reckon Basco knows this off
by now. No, I wouldn't have a clue as to how much it made. I know it was very well critically received, but I don't know how much it made.
I think it's around the 400,000 region.
Worldwide?
Yes.
No.
It's
6,000? Million.
Thousand. Oh, no, million. 400 million.
400,000 didn't even break even worldwide.
just we watched it many times. No.
2001. I'd say 200, 300 mil.
No, so it may
be more than 400 mil then.
It's more. It's 897 million.
Wow.
Adjusted for inflation, it's 1.4 billion. Yeah, wow. 1.4 billion. So, it did extremely well. But
400 domestically.
Which domestic? U.S. domestic? Probably.
That's incredible. Whichever fits 400. It's incredible because of the Hollywood accounting thing that goes on. New Line actually claimed they didn't turn a profit for this film.
Oh, yeah. Hollywood accounting, they use it as a tax write-off. So they say every movie doesn't make a profit and then they don't need to pay taxes on the profit.
Which is a blatant...
Which is also why they're writing off all those Warner Brothers movies.
They're just complete tax write-offs.
Yeah.
But most movies are claimed to not be profitable.
Yeah.
Because they say the marketing cost is double that of the production cost. So how much did this cost to make?
93
million.
Yeah.
So they'll say the marketing cost was 200 million.
Yeah. It's still profit though.
Domestically.
Still, yeah.
It's so insidious. I remember there was a massive lawsuit after this between Peter Jackson and New Line Cinema. Yeah. And it only just got resolved before the Hobbit films came out.
Yeah. Okay.
So like I had no idea this was going on in the background. I was just like, oh, these films came out. They're so magical. But all this stuff goes on in the background and you kind of think.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it just this film or like the subsequent movies made more than this actually?
Yeah, it was the whole thing combined. I think they had a contract for the three. So
yeah,
it was a.
But yes, they're very commercially successful, despite what New Line Cinema wants to say, and obviously critically acclaimed. It's won, I think it won two Academy Awards. So it got nominated for quite a few things, but it only won for, I think it was visual effects and costume design or something along those lines. All right. I guess we can jump into our... I was going to go through the cast, but the cast is just way too big and everyone knows who's in this movie. So maybe we'll just jump to our thoughts on this movie, Fellowship of the Ring, first. We'll go around. So we'll start with you.
Okay. Do you want me to do any plot? Nah, don't need to do plot. We can do that later.
Yeah, plot. I don't know if we... When we go through spoilers, kind of go through
the plot. I would have put the ring in the lava.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the plot.
Yeah.
There's a little bit more to it, but
that's the simplified version. Yeah,
there's nothing more to it.
So I have, yeah, there's nothing more. nothing yeah. more. That's it. Yeah, yeah. It's just a road trip, and they're
When you ask, because our parents have seen these movies, when you ask my mum what the plot for this is, she's just like, "Yeah, why don't they just go and put the ring in the lava? Like, what? Why is it taking them so long to do it?" So that's her explanation for this every time. So yeah. Anyway,
okay. High level thoughts. I haven't seen this movie in a very long time. I don't think I've seen it in like over 10 years. It's been a very long time.
Wow.
But it holds up very well considering how long ago it came out. So, like, the visual effects are quite amazing. And I think it's the combination of the practical effects and visual effects that makes it look so good. It came out 2001.
Yeah.
No movie from 2001 looks this good.
Yeah. Well, some movies from, like, this year don't look this good.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Obviously, there's still some parts that are dated, but for the most of it, it looks amazing. Mm. The cast is very good. This is a slight negative. I don't know if everyone agrees with this, but I don't think Elijah Wood is great in all three of these. But I think that other than that, the rest of the cast is really good. Overall, it's just a really good time. Doesn't take itself too seriously, but it is serious. There's like moments of levity. It's handled very well. And it's an ensemble cast as well. It's basically like an Avengers movie in terms of the cast, but they handle it quite well, giving every cast member enough to do. So
yeah,
overall, I think technically it's probably the thing that stands out the most for me. But other than that, it's still amazing on all fronts.
Yeah.
I think it might be my favorite out of all three of them.
But we're going to watch the next two.
We're going to watch the next two, so maybe not.
Yeah.
But I think this is my favorite. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Bhaskar, what are your thoughts?
Wow. Watching this again the other day was just like a big trip down memory lane. You know?
Yeah.
It's, I know a lot of people have reviewed Lord of the Rings in the past and the cultural zeitgeist it's had, it still continues to this day. Still people are still coming on board. I feel like I might go different with my approach to this film. I'm going to talk about the emotional impact it had.
Yeah.
Because everyone can talk about its critical and its technical, mastery. For me, I remember watching it as a kid and I was like, the first time I saw the trailer for Lord of the Rings, I just thought it was a fantasy film that someone wanted to make. I didn't know it was based off a book. I didn't know it was based off anything existing. I was just like, this looks really, really fantastical and magical. And I want to watch what this is about. I don't care about the characters. I didn't recognize any of the actors. They were all new to me at the time. I didn't recognize any elements. It was the first time seeing anything like this before. So, like, when I saw it, I was only 9 years old, 10 years old.
2001, so we would have been...
2001. Oh, no, we would have been 12, 13, 12, 12 13, around that ripe age.
You would have been 12, yeah.
Yeah. So, we were teenagers, just entering into, teenage years. And it was... I sat through that film, not knowing what Lord of the Rings was about, never heard that name ever. And I was just blown away by the film because it was so enthralling. It kind of really just dives deep and puts you in the film. It's that kind of thing where you know how people are getting into like Dungeons and Dragons now and are playing like party massively multiplayer influence. Online games. Like this was the OG dungeon crawl experience of watching a team and you have your ranger, you have your mage, you have your little hobbits going around and like
and
watch
orcs.
Them yeah and yeah. just watch them. Dive into the most ungodly environments where you don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, it is an adventure. Like you kind of feel like you're just thrown into an adventure.
Yeah.
So like I recommend this movie to everyone who hasn't seen it because it's just like if you've ever had an imaginative kind of experience with a book or with a TV series, like this is something that starts many people off on that journey. I'm pretty sure this was the film that got me starting to appreciate filmmaking. Before this, I was just watching films like,
entertainment.
Like Steven Spielberg films and going, oh, that's really cool. I wish I could fly like Hook, like Peter Pan does in Hook. Or I wish I could, be Mowgli in the jungle. This was the first one where I was watching going, how did they do this? And it actually got me thinking about behind the screen and what goes into making something so magical. So really, really culturally and personally like important film.
Definitely. You would have been super young when this came out. So.
I was, yeah. I don't think I remember the first time I saw it, if I'm honest. But looking back on it now, similar to what Torrin mentioned before, I'm still amazed at how well it holds up, in this day and age. I remember looking at, like, in hindsight now, when you take a look at some of the behind the scenes and whatnot, and how they do some of that cinematography, all the camera shots. I'm just amazed at how hard it is to actually spot some of those things, and you only spot it if you know what happens behind the scenes. But it's just such a, I'm tempted to say flawless, piece of work for that day and age. But yeah, just running through, like, there's nothing that I can really think that stands out as something that I would say is a negative. Cinematography is done really, really well. The music for the first film was excellent. Howard Shore, I don't know how he does it, but it's just the way, like, it draws you in. Vasco mentioned it's an adventure. I think for me as well, even though it's a long movie, it covers a lot. Like, when you think about where it starts and where it ends.
There's nothing redundant. Like, exactly, what would you take out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, even in the extended edition, you can kind of understand why they took out some of those extended scenes. But, you know, that everything fits. Like, everything's got a purpose. And you really do feel like it's 3 hours well spent for the theatrical release. Whereas some movies nowadays, like two and a half hours, 20 minutes, and it's like not much really happens. So, yeah, there's very little I can say that's negative about it. It's just overall a really positive experience. And I think what I liked the most about it all was the fact that the movies came out year after year. That was a good plan. And it just meant that, you know, you didn't lose any of that space in between where you're like, what happened? Because a lot of movies nowadays, sequels are coming out 3-4 years later, and it's like you have to go back, rewatch it, start picking out flaws and whatnot. So, yeah, look, overall, just a positive experience for me, Fellowship of the Ring. There's nothing really that I can say.
I mean, I agree with everything that said. Since we're recollecting our theatrical experiences, I remember pretty distinctly where we watched this and why we watched this. So we weren't actually
Knox VMAX.
No, it was actually Century City, and it was late. It was like a 9:30 show, and it was on a Sunday night, and we didn't actually plan to watch it. My dad wanted to watch it, so he's like, "Oh, there's a movie called Lord of the Rings. Let's go check it out." We didn't know it was 3 hours long. He didn't know it was 3 hours long either. He had work the next day. And then we got to we bought the tickets, and then Dad was like, "Oh, so how long's the movie?" And they're like, "Oh, it finishes at 12:45. And they're like, "What? That's the 3 hours." But then we'd already bought the tickets. So we went in, and yeah, it was like the biggest surprise for me, because I'd only seen one trailer when we watched Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the theatrical trailer, and then went in pretty much blind. Like, it doesn't happen these days where you go into a movie not knowing anything about it.
Yeah.
This was one of those experiences, and yeah, complete surprise. And I didn't even know that there was two more movies.
Yeah.
So it ended. I'm like, oh, that's an abrupt end. Like, aren't they going to finish it? And then realize that there's two more movies coming out. So yeah, got me completely hyped. And that was a long year of waiting for Two Towers to come out. Yeah. So. Yeah, no, it was a great, great theatrical experience back then. And in terms of my thoughts on the movie now, it's like you all said, it's still, it passed the test of time with flying colors. It's amazing in terms of how it looks now. The main thing for me is, like you said, the emotional impact. Like, there's a lot of, and this comes from the writing of J.R.R. Tolkien, obviously, but the philosophical undertones that are in this movie. And I'm going to play a scene when we get into spoilers that really resonated with me now, something that Gandalf says. It was stuff like that, like those philosophical undertones and just the depth in the characters and the dialogue that really resonated with me this time. And also the camaraderie within the Fellowship, because they only join the Fellowship halfway through the movie.
Correct.
So they really set it up in the first half. And another thing that kind of resonated with me this time was that you spend a lot of time in the Shire. And like, I remember back then, like, oh, why can't we just get into the action? Like, why are we spending this time? But it makes sense now, because you need to feel the sense of being out of the Hobbit's comfort zone. Yeah. So spend time in the Shire, so that Hobbits live in this very peaceful Shire. It's very quiet, very slow. And then you see Frodo and the rest of the Hobbits move out of the Shire and in chaos, essentially, like a lot of danger. And you feel that because you know where they've come from. Yep. So it really takes the audience on that journey. So I really respect that they took the time to, you know, just have that Shire sequence and everything that happens there. So, yeah, I could keep talking about this, but we should probably jump to spoilers soon. Obviously, this is a masterpiece. We still got two more to talk about, but I really like Fellowship of the Ring. When it came out, after I watched all three, I was actually ranking this second. I liked it better than Two Towers, And then Return of King was on top. But let's see what happens this time around.
Absolutely. I had the same ranking when I was younger, but I think, we'll find out when we watch Return of the King. But I think I don't like it as much as I did. It's got cool parts though. Yeah. But I think this is the only movie that the Fellowship is actually together.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
They do split them up.
No other movie when they're together.
Yeah. It's quite a nice feeling seeing them together and like that initial, you know, the journey and they're all kind of protecting each other. And it's kind of nice. I kind of, when you're watching the later films, you kind of feel that separation of the Fellowship. And it's like you're following three separate storylines. Mm. And you don't see them reunite until the very end. At which point they kind of just spend some time and disband again.
Yeah. Well, they meet at the very end when all the tension's kind of gone as well. So
yeah,
when the ring's in lava.
It's already in there.
When the ring has dissolved.
Spoilers.
Yeah. There was one point I wanted to follow on what Sriven said about that establishing that sense of comfort in the Shire before throwing this party in the deep end. And I feel like that was done masterfully on many levels. One of them is like the opening crawl to the film is like the camera pans over the map of the Shire and it shows like Bockleberry Ferry, you know, the great big tree and Bag End, and slowly zooms out. It's very careful not to show too much of the world. It just shows that little neck of the woods.
Yeah.
What Bilbo grew up around and like, you know, spending his youth in the woods of, the Took Forest and coming around like the boundaries of his world is the wild, which is just like the natural trees and that kind of stuff. When they go and they leave the Shire, and, you know, Sam has that beautiful moment of, you know, this is the furthest away I've ever been. But when they actually leave and they go past Weathertop, you never see the map again. And every step is like uncharted territory.
Something new, yeah.
Yeah, even Rivendell is like, these guys have never been in Rivendell. Yeah. It's just weird. And then they cross Moria and it's just like,
it's the furthest he's ever been.
It's like, yeah, every step is literally unknown. And we'll talk about that YouTube video online. It's like that 72-hour long video. But that feeling of just being completely isolated and like you don't know what's around the corner or what's hiding really mimics the feel of the books. Because when you read the books the very first time, on the left sleeve there's a map of Hobbiton and the Shire. The actual world map is on the very other end of the book.
Ah, okay.
So it's like it's a bit intimidating for you to go past everything and you're free to look at it, but it's like what's familiar is what you start off with.
Mm.
And when you look at the world map, it's on the very other end of the book. So it's like, yeah, it gives it the Peter Jackson really thought a lot about how much he wants to convey that sense of adventure.
Any non-spoiler comments that we want to make? Obviously, cognitive recal, I think everyone's going to give it a. We should probably have another scale for this movie, to be honest, other than cognitive recalibration and regression. But yeah, obviously, we recommend it. Definitely go watch it. Watch the extended editions. I think it's worth the time investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's also a 4K remastered edition that just came out.
Came out in 2020. Yeah.
Fully regraded, recolored.
Yeah.
Peter Jackson sat down and did it himself. So, yeah, check that out. I'm keen to check it out as well.
All right. I guess we'll jump to spoilers. So, if you haven't seen Fellowship of the Ring, we just told you, go watch it. Come back to this point and listen to our spoilers.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I mean, we can go. We don't have to go through every story because we will literally be here for 4 hours if we do that. Yeah. So we'll go through high level what we think. But there was one part that I wanted to that dialogue that I wanted to sort of discuss because it kind of foreshadows everything that's going to happen. Firstly, and almost very relevant to what we've been through in the last 2 years or so. So let's watch.
It's a pity Bilbo didn't kill him when he had the chance.
Pity. It was pity that stayed Bilbo's hand. Many that lived deserved death, and some that die deserve life. Can you give it to them, Frodo? Do not be too eager to deal out death and judgment. Even the very wise cannot see all ends. My heart tells me that Gollum has some part to play yet, for good or ill. Before this is over, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of many.
I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that is an encouraging thought.
I was a bit confused for a little bit. I think you start the scene off a bit too early. but I get it now.
Such a nice scene.
Yeah, the words about Smeagol were very, very moving indeed.
Yeah, what's he guarded from this?
actually,
the English lecturer bullshit he's going to pull out here.
For the last 2 years.
So the first part of that exchange is about Smeagol. There are actually some important things that come out of that as well. So obviously the second part is much more profound, I think. But the first part where he talks about there's one thing he says towards the end where he says, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of men, which is true because he let Smeagol live, which is technically why all of this is happening in a way. So, yeah, I thought that was really good. But the second part is really what I wanted to focus on. So around where he says we have to live with what we are given. So, like, Frodo's like, oh, I wish this didn't happen, that didn't happen. A lot of people wish the last 2 years didn't happen for us. But you have to live with the cards you're dealt,
well,
I guess.
Yeah. Not everyone. This guy got married in the last 2 years. I'm sure he doesn't know. I'm going to take that back.
I thought that was...
Well, he did what was... He was using the time that was given to him, so it was good.
Yeah, you used the time that was given to you.
To get married.
My
hand's going up for anyone.
It was a fellowship. Jesus Christ. With rings involved.
Yeah, there was. I noted down a couple of dot points. So you never know how things may turn out in life. The power of mercy, which is the first part. How a small action may cause a massive chain of events. Dark times are inevitable, but the most important thing is how you face them. And things happen for a reason, even if you can't understand that at all times. The reason is never evil.
That quote, like he was saying, there's other forces at work here other than the will of evil.
Yeah.
And that includes the will of all the people there trying to do something, which is really, really kind of powerful. Kind of touches on Stoic philosophy a bit.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, instead of complaining or feeling self-pity, think about what you're tasked with, how much time you have, and just do what you can with the tools you have.
That's right, yeah. And he ends that deeply philosophical exchange with encouragement, essentially, saying, Bilbo was meant to get the ring. You were meant to have it.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here. So
It kind of shows that that's what wisdom used to mean, like the old wisdom of like the old days where it was like, it wasn't this secret knowledge. Even the way they show Gandalf using magic, it's never gratuitous. in a childish way. It's very mystical. It's a sense of like his wisdom came from a sense of being a spirit that's been on this earth for thousands of years. That's what Gandalf is, a Maiar spirit. So Bardgar would know more about actually the origins of this. But can you speak to like what, when he's talking about there are other forces at work here, do you think he's referencing like the gods of the realm or like the spirits and the Maiar spirits?
No, I don't think he's referencing the Maiar spirits in general. I think he's just talking to the fact that there are just other elements that control what's going on around, right? Like, and it speaks to the fact that you can never really truly be in control of a situation, and to do so would be to seek power that would be outside your control.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, like Gandalf's whole purpose on Middle-earth was to kindle hope in the hearts of men. And yeah. In this case, he does it in all races, not just in men. And that's the best part about a character like that. It's like, it's that character that you kind of wish you had in your life, kindling hope, providing that encouragement, and doing it in a way where you say as few words as required, but the message gets across.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but this exchange in the book actually happens much earlier. So it's before they get to the mines.
Correct, yeah.
But I think this placement actually works really well because they've actually been through some peril.
With the peril. And yeah. They're in the darkest place they could possibly find themselves. It's pretty depressing.
Yeah. It's the first real test for Frodo. I mean, like, obviously Weathertop was a crazy test, but this is like after he's made the choice to take it. This is the first real challenge that comes ahead. In the books, it happens, I believe it happens after Gandalf reveals that the ring Bilbo had is the One Ring.
Yes.
Yeah. So when they're in that room, that's when he actually says that this is the One Ring, and Frodo's like, I wish it need not happen in my time.
Because that's when he actually understands the weight of what's about to happen.
Correct. But I don't think, that's the thing, I don't think he truly does understand because he hasn't been outside the Shire in the book at that stage.
Yeah.
Whereas in here, I think what Peter Jackson did was right in that he's given Frodo enough experience to have that quote have a little more impact than it did in the books. So it's good. I love the way that it played here in Moria because it's like dark. It's like unfamiliar territory. Even Gandalf is like kind of lost in the way. So it's like, it's that when that figure who's always there is also kind of lost, that's when you truly feel kind of helpless, right? So it's a great, great scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the great thing about this whole trilogy is we watch a lot of movies now where we're like, oh, that character was a bit dull. Like there was nothing to them. They don't have a personality. Every single character has their own unique personality in this trilogy.
Mm.
Even if the most minor characters, like you don't spend that much time with some of the Fellowship, but even then you can say their character, what their character's like and their unique character features, which is really refreshing in after watching a lot of movies where that's definitely not present.
True. And full credit to Tolkien for actually coming up with that dynamic. Yeah,
I think that's
having the chitty chatty hobbits, the really boisterous dwarf, who in the books is not a comic relief. He's actually very serious and battle experienced. He's like a tank.
Yeah.
And
and even within the hobbits, they have their own personalities as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't remember how Tolkien described it, but it was like he actually separated each one's tendencies. And then he went down to saying, when they were in the midst of like Legolas and Aragorn talking about, these other concepts, they just couldn't relate. And Legolas has always got this third eye, keeps seeing things that the other team doesn't see. And like if he can feel the atmosphere and the emotion of the air. Like I remember one scene, I think it's in another movie, but it's like a red sun rises, blood has been spilt this night. Like none of the other people are equipped with that connection to the environment or to the natural world. And he is. So it's like,
he's always showing off, that guy.
Yeah, Taron doesn't like. He's like, no one asked you, Legolas. Like
he's giving out information that no one needs.
He even tries to alpha Gandalf at one point in this. Remember?
When does he try and alpha?
Remember in the mines, how they're on the bridge thing, and then he's like, Gandalf.
Gandalf's like, none of that, mate. We're going to kill myself because of you.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Is it the part where he's jumping? The part where he's jumping.
Yeah.
Not the part where he fights the Balrog.
No.
The Mines of Moria.
Yeah.
That's a great part.
Yeah, that's a great part.
The Mines of Moria probably the highlight of this movie, I reckon.
It's so, heart racing. The action is nonstop. I mean, well, initially the first half of it's very slow, very, very, you're kind of scared about what's going to happen. Is something going to happen? And then Pippin breaks the silence. But from that point onwards, it's just a constant race to get out. And it just keeps escalating and escalating and escalating. And the Balrog comes.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite scenes when they're surrounded by goblins in Duradelph. completely about to get ruined by these goblins, and then suddenly they hear a roar, and then all the goblins run away, and you just see this like orange light approach them. And then Gandalf is like slowly, he understands what it is. No one else knows what's going on. And all you notice is that Legolas has this ghostly white look on his face. Because and I think this is the genius of Peter Jackson. It's like he knows the books. He's read the Silmarillion. He's read all the things about the fall of Gondolin and how the High Elves were, you know, defeated by Morgoth. Balrogs attacked them. Imagine being a kid like Legolas, growing up with like all these stories about how your ancestors were destroyed by these demon beings called Balrogs. And now there's one approaching, and he's just like, he doesn't know what to do. He's just frozen. And like Orlando Bloom plays that scene beautifully. It's the tension building is perfect.
And this is his first acting credit.
Ah, true.
Yeah. That's real.
I think he blew up after this.
Yes. Yeah. They got Pirates after this.
And then he fell in
after that.
I think he actually auditioned for another role. I think it was like Faramir that he auditioned for, but he was unsuccessful for that. But then they called him back because they thought he was more suitable for Legolas.
It's a good show off, yeah.
Maybe we can go through each character in the Fellowship. That might be a good way to sort of go through this conversation. So we've kind of talked about Frodo and Gandalf already and some of the Hobbits, but Aragorn, obviously, he ends up being probably
the trio are the best characters. Aragorn, Gimli, Legolas.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he ends up being, obviously, in the third one, Return of the King is actually him.
He's probably the main – Frodo is kind of the main character, but I would say Aragorn's kind of equal billing with – I don't know if it's the same in the book, if Frodo
in the books – no, in the books, it is very much a Frodo thing, but also it does jump around. I think what J.R.R. Tolkien does well is that he doesn't establish a main character per se. You could argue that it's Gandalf for a fair bit of it. And then you could argue that Frodo takes precedence. You could argue it's Aragorn. And then you could argue, I think at one point, it's like there's a fair bit on just Gimli and like the dwarves and stuff. So, and then Samwise has a fair chunk attributed to him as well. So again, I don't think it's really like a main character sort of situation, but it's not as loose as like Game of Thrones, for example, where it's like every character has their own perspective.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you could definitely argue that the story is effectively about not only all the races, but about how men, because it's the age of men. That's what it's like leading all up to.
Yeah.
So yeah, Aragorn is definitely like
the forefront. I find his arc probably the most interesting in the whole.
Yeah,
yeah,
trilogy. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Playing off that whole trope of the leader who does not want to lead.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's really interesting.
The reluctant.
Yeah. I wouldn't say
actually in the books he did.
No, in the books, I wouldn't say he doesn't want to lead. I think he's just weary of what happens when
men go into
when
power.
His bloodline, but also, yeah, with everything that you have to remember, he was raised by elves.
Yeah.
And elves don't have the best fondness for men, especially Elrond. Yeah. So you're raised by someone like that, you're going to have tendencies that men aren't the best people to go around. That's why he ended up becoming a ranger and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. And just to clarify for anyone who's not familiar, when we talk about men, we're talking about the race of men in Lord of the Rings. Like there's men, there's elves, there's dwarves,
not
there's
the gender.
Not the gender. So this includes women as well, obviously.
Yes,
so
yeah.
It's just a nomenclature that Tolkien uses to refer to races.
Yes.
So
yeah, it does. Yeah.
I mean, we'll quickly touch on this because the new show, I mean, for good or bad, they're introducing new races, so it's much more multicultural. But it never bothered me that this wasn't multicultural, to be honest, because you said it last week when we were watching the movie that it's geographically specific. Like in this part of the world, there are white people. That's it.
Oh, yeah, it was based off of European, like Highland. It was a high fantasy based off of very European. Obviously, the Rolling Hills represent what the Rolling Hills are in, you know, London and Ireland and Scotland. And this was medieval times. Well, the way that the story was written was to try and create a actual history of England, like an ancient history, because there was no there was no law of English law. Most of English law, like King Arthur and stuff, we saw this in a documentary, is attributed to the Normans. So it was like the French. It's not actually English. So, and Tolkien actually does write, there are cities to the south. There are legions of countries to the east that have slightly Middle Eastern, slightly African heritage. And this was what battle and kind of the high fantasy series was like. So when we watched it, it didn't seem like I'm pretty sure there was an era where we watched stuff, it was mostly whitewashed. There was not much.
Anyway,
like,
yeah.
There was no, if there was an Indian guy in Lord of the Rings, I would have been like, that's weird.
That looks out of place.
That's out of place. I don't like this film. And like, I'm not the kind of guy to be like, oh, I see myself. I saw myself in Frodo.
Yeah.
I saw myself in Boromir, actually. He's my favorite character of Fellowship. I was like, I saw myself in all these characters because they were written so well. It didn't matter what color skin they were wearing. It was like, this is a high fantasy. If I'm reading about Lord of the Rings, it's probably going to be someone who the author is trying to emulate or trying to grow up with. So it's like,
yeah.
I guess from my point of view, I don't think it matters what the race is. As long as the actor plays it well, it doesn't really matter what race they are.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy novel. It's a fantasy novel. It's not based on
anything real.
Yeah. So they can be whatever you want them to be, really. If it's based on an actual historical event and it's based off white people and you put an Indian guy in there, then that's obviously wrong. You shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But with a fantasy novel, just pick the best person to play the role.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what race they are.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's keep going. So we've spoken about Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli. They're a bit of a team going forward, actually, in this movie. They're all together. But
it's a good trio, great trio.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially the whole dynamic between Legolas and Gimli, how they're elves and dwarves don't get along. And they kind of,
by the end of it, they're
good friends. Yeah. And then even Aragorn and Legolas, because, like you said, Aragorn was brought up by elves, so they have a bit of a connection. Just inherently, they have a connection.
Yeah.
And I think they both really respect each other as warriors as well. Mm. Whereas Gimli respects Aragorn, but not so much Legolas at the beginning.
Yeah. He literally accuses him of wanting to take the ring for himself in the film, at least. I don't know about how much the House of Elrond is.
They have kill races and stuff towards the end. And
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there was one scene in the extended editions in Fellowship. It was a beautiful moment where I feel like Peter Jackson wanted to show Legolas is actually contemplating maybe elves and dwarves can get along. Maybe it can happen. And it's that scene where right after they leave Lorien and, Galadriel is giving everyone the gifts.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. And in the extended edition, you actually see everyone getting a gift except for Boromir.
Mm.
In the theatrical edition, I think you only see Aragorn, Frodo, and someone else getting a gift. Only three people.
Yeah.
This one, everyone gets a gift. You don't see Gimli getting anything. Legolas is with Gimli on the boat. They're riding, and then Legolas is like, "What did you ask of her?" And then Gimli's like, "I asked for three golden hairs from the top of her head. I asked for one golden hair from her head, and she gave me three." And you just see Legolas kind of contemplatively smiling and going, "They can go off the distance." It's like a completely. If anyone missed the reference, it's just another pass by scene. There's so much significance behind that scene, though. It's because if you go back and read the history of Lord of the Rings and Silmarillion, it's that when you look at Fëanor, who created the Silmarils, is one of the High Elves, he modeled the Silmarils, which is the ancient jewels
just
that
reside,
really gems. Important jewels with like the which had the power of the elements. He requested a golden hair from Galadriel three times because he modeled the jewels off her. He was infatuated with her, technically. She rejected him three times. And for her to give Gimli three of her hairs is kind of to say, well, I'm giving you three times what this guy asked me of. And so I think Legolas is contemplating. He knows the story. So his smile is like, maybe dwarves and elves can get along. If Galadriel can recognize that one, it's such a cool little moment. And someone posted it on Tumblr and it became viral. And it's just like, these gems are still being found today. Like all the little details that Peter Jackson put into them.
Yeah.
Still being found today, like small, small little stuff.
That was a good little moment. Yeah, I didn't know about it until it's good that we watched it together because then I got that insight.
Yeah, and after that moment, Legolas actually tries to be more friendly around Gimli.
Gimli was always a bit hostile. Legolas wasn't really hostile, but you could tell that he didn't really like him either. You could tell that they didn't like each other, especially in that when they first formed their fellowship. So that they're in Rivendell and, you've got everyone meeting and that scene is one of the best scenes as well in this movie. Gimli hits it with his axe and, even in that scene, everyone starts fighting. You can see that the men start fighting
open discord.
Yeah. And even Gandalf's getting in there as well and Frodo's the one that stops it in the end. But that's a great scene.
I think it's because an element of it was the fact that they're all royalty. If you look at all the Fellowship members, except the Hobbits, obviously, but Aragorn, future king, Boromir is the son of the steward, Legolas, Prince of Mirkwood, and Gimli is the nephew of Balin, Lord of Moria. It's coming from highly opinionated and very privileged backgrounds, I suppose. Yeah. But it's that's where those arguments stem from. And it's where that, I think it's where that kind of that bias may come from, at least with the elves and the dwarves. It's that if you, and I guess the Hobbit movies kind of touch on it. I'm not sure if they do it too well, but the fact that that opinion is so ingrained in them, it's like it makes sense because they come from that royal background where those opinions would be like thriving at the heart. So,
yeah. It touches on that idea of prejudice that transcends generations.
Yeah.
Because that prejudice between elves and dwarves has been there since the older days, which is like thousands of years ago.
Since the dawn of time, yeah.
Since the dawn of time. And it's just like, how is this generational race prejudice continued on to this day? And you see the fallout of it. And even like Elrond is talking about men with disdain, like saying,
yeah,
men are weak. Yeah. You know, the age of men is over. Yeah, there's no hope in that line. That's and it's like Gandalf is looking at it all going, you guys are squabbling like children.
Yeah.
There's even that scene where like, everyone's fighting. He's like, as you argue, Sauron's power grows, you'll all be destroyed. Yeah. And he, no one's listening to him.
Yes.
So it's like, it's really interesting to see that
overseer. Real world kind of stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah. That
there's kind of so many applicable themes to today.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yes. Somehow it's become, I think it will always be applicable to stuff happening in the real world in some way or another. It's interesting that you bring up that everyone is royalty. This is going, I still remember this dialogue, going all the way to Return of the King. One of the very last scenes, there's like 20 last scenes in that, but one of the last scenes where
no one
bows to you.
Yeah.
So the only non-royalty were the hobbits and everyone's bowing to them. Yeah. So
one of the 20 endings in that movie. we'll get to it.
Yeah.
That was a really nice emotional scene.
Boromir.
Boromir.
Talked about Boromir.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boromir. Yeah. Sean Bean.
He's, When I first saw it, I probably didn't appreciate the character as much. I'm like, oh, this guy's just a bit of a dick. But you see, as you get older, when you're younger, you want to be Aragorn. As you get older, you sympathize with Boromir, I reckon.
Yeah.
You kind of see where he's coming from.
Yeah. He's one of those characters where I think the extended edition in Two Towers really shines a light on his background.
Yes.
Well, the pressure that he has from his family.
Yeah.
And you see in the following movies, you see that.
Well, he sees his father as well.
Once you see that and then you come back to this, it has a greater effect as well because you're like, oh, okay, this guy was, under a whole load of pressure.
He was a highly misunderstood character. And I still feel this angst of like, what if he had lived and he was with the four, like with, Aragorn, Gimli, Legolas, just going to Rohan, going to, like he's a wonderful warrior. He's a great fighter he's quite a philosopher in the books as well. He has really interesting thoughts, but he has his mortal weakness, and almost like a Shakespearean weakness.
He just wants to be that person that he wants to be the person that ends it all. He wants to be the hero. He wants to make his dad proud, essentially. But he'll do whatever it takes to get there.
Yeah. Even more so, he's actually his entire appeal of give me the ring so I can save my people is actually very noble and absolutely makes sense on paper. He just simply doesn't acknowledge that he has a weakness to this power.
Yeah.
That he can't see that it's going to drive him mad and drive him to do things like he was going to kill Frodo. Like, straight up, he was about to kill him, take the ring. And he doesn't see that until it's too late.
And there is it's very subtle. You don't see much of it, but he obviously has a fondness towards the other two hobbits, Pippin and Merry.
And he dies trying to save them.
Yeah. Essentially, correct. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Still to this day, that is one of the most heart-wrenching death scenes. Not because it's violent. It's just long, and it's just very, very emotionally, distraught with emotion because he's still fighting when he's dying to the last breath. And, that final scene when Aragorn is talking to a dying Boromir, that's probably my favorite scene of that film. Just because there's so many things that aren't, like while he's talking, there's a choir singing in the background. The choir singing actual lyrics from the book. And I remember, I just wanted to read this out. What he says, I'll find it actually. You guys can continue talking. I'll come back to this point. But it's basically talking about how that there is no lust for battle. No one wants to fight for glory. It's that I'm fighting to defend that which is purest, which is the innocence of the kids and the soldiers and stuff.
On that scene, actually, because I think in the book, Aragorn just finds him and he's dead, right? Doesn't actually have that exchange, and he doesn't actually fight the. So, firstly, let's now that we're here, let's talk about this character who's the Uruk-hai leader. What was his name? I put
Lertz.
It in there.
Lertz.
Yeah,
this guy's fucking jacked. First off,
jacked, amazing, yeah. And played by Lawrence Wahala. He's a Maori stuntman, amazing actor.
That character is actually made for this movie, so that character didn't exist in the books. There was a lot of like hawks and Uruk-hais and stuff, but nothing like a central.
They needed a villain,
a central
villain.
Yeah,
for this movie.
Someone they could. Yeah.
Like this is the guy, and they need to kill him off at the end. So. He was good.
Yeah. And
he knows the history of the orcs.
Yes. or how the orcs came to be.
How the orcs came to be. Yeah. So there's a scene in the movie where just after he's born, isn't it?
Yes. Or yeah, like, yeah, after he's created.
From the spawning pits in Isengard.
Yeah. And then Saruman asks him, do you know the history of the orcs?
Yeah.
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 He doesn't. Well, he doesn't answer him. Yeah.
Hey, I blame him. He's only like he's only 5 minutes old.
That's his expression. It's like, how would I know that?
I don't know English, man.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you saying?
Yeah, I show that scene to my wife whenever she's like trying to explain something to me that I don't know anything about. I'm like, that's you. This is me. You're Saruman. Yeah, so that guy, obviously they introduced that guy, but he plays a very effective role because he kills Boromir, and then almost immediately you get released because Aragorn comes and fights him, and they have a very good battle. And you were saying that one of the stunts wasn't meant to be the way it turned out, but they kept the scene anyway because he chucks a blade or a dagger?
Dagger. Yeah. This was in the director's commentary. That's why I couldn't find it when we were going through it. Yeah, like Lertz picks up this dagger and chucks it straight at Viggo Mortensen. And it was not meant to be a direct throw. It was meant to be an off-angle throw to kind of throw it in the direction, then they would cut it, then reshoot another scene where the blade's flying close to Viggo and he kind of hits it out of the air. No, what happened was Lertz, the guy who played Lertz, he had prosthetics over his eyes. He couldn't see. He threw this knife, which was a metal prop. It wasn't sharp, but it was a metal prop. Threw it straight at Viggo Mortensen, directly at his face. And then Viggo batted the knife out with his prop metal sword in midair on the first take. And it was like, they shot it. And this wasn't shot by Peter Jackson, it was shot by the second unit. So Peter Jackson didn't know about this. It was done by the stunt team. And so when they shot it and they filmed it, they did it one take, they ended it. And someone told Peter Jackson, like, he actually hit the blade out of the air. And Peter's reaction was like, oh really? Like, just amusement.
Yeah.
So it comes off really well in the film. Which is one of those.
If that didn't happen, that could have been the end of that movie.
Could have been.
Yeah. Trilogy,
if you didn't imagine the actor for Lertz being on trial for killing Viggo Mortensen.
We would have just seen like a small news article somewhere.
What's the guy?
Alec Baldwin?
Yeah, it could have been an Alec Baldwin sesh. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, true.
Thank goodness it wasn't. But that's just one of many stunt stories that are crazy.
That's right, yeah. And the stuntman, or I think they had a key swordsman that was training all the people in the Fellowship.
Yeah.
And he said Viggo Mortensen was the best actor he's ever trained with a sword. So he took it very seriously. And he kept the sword as well.
He kept the sword. Like,
nice sword.
In the appendices, they were talking about when Viggo Mortensen was in character, he would train at the gym with his swordmaster. And in costume, he would carry the sword, go to a cafe, sit down, put the sword on the table, and order a meal and just eat. Like, he would take it everywhere he went.
It was in character.
And people were just like, in Waitapu, they were looking at, what the hell is this guy? Yeah. Why is he dressed like a medieval swordsman?
Yeah.
So he
well,
he
at least
of
that was in New Zealand. If he did that in, you know, America, walking around with a sword, I don't know if he would have gotten away with it.
No, it's open carry. It's cool to see the attention to detail these actors put into their roles. And, that fight scene with Lertz was one of the really intense fight scenes. It's kind of funny because I remember there being a lot of dismemberment and blood splurting. Like, he cuts his arm off.
It's pretty bloodless, I think.
There was no splurting, right?
Maybe we watched it when we were young. I remember thinking it was violent when we were young.
Yeah.
But watching it now, it's not very.
Because that's apparently the line that makes it MA15+.
Yes.
It doesn't need blood.
Yeah.
But there was lots of blood in Moria, so I'm like, what the hell? I found that quote, by the way.
Yes.
So when this is when he defeats Lertz, he goes and he runs and gets Boromir, and Boromir's just basically saying they took the little ones and the hobbits are gone, Merry and Pippin are taken. I'll never go back to my city, Minas Tirith. I'm never going to see my people again. And then Aragorn's just like reassuring him, saying, don't worry, we will restore Gondor to its greatness. Like, that's the first time he actually accepts, we will bring it back. Don't worry. He kind of makes a promise to him. And then in the background, the choir is singing in Elvish. And no one picks it up, but the lyrics are, I do not love the sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I only love what they defend. And the real kicker is, in the book, those lines were said by his little brother, Faramir.
Ah.
So they brought that back in, and that's such an amazing little callback. That's really, like, that kind of hits home as to what the ethos of the warrior was in Tolkien's universe. It wasn't bloodlust. That's what the Uruk-hai was. They were just fighting for bloodlust. So that's not what these guys were doing.
While we're on the matter of takes that weren't meant to happen, but they ended up keeping, it's not as impressive as Viggo Mortensen's one, but when Gandalf hits his head in the when he comes to Hobbiton.
Oh, in Bag End?
In Bag End. That was unscripted. So
yeah,
Ian McKellen hit his head and he kind of kept acting. So he's like, so that owl that he says, which is quite a big owl, it was actual pain. He was in.
I can't imagine the suffering he must have gone through, because they had to build two Bag Ends, one to scale that made Gandalf appear giant, and one that was made for Ian Malcolm, I believe, the guy who played Bilbo.
Yes,
to look a normal size, and also Elijah Wood. Yeah, a lot of nice camera work, filmmaking. Like I told you, this is a mastery in filmmaking. This movie. If you ever wondered what it's like to be a director, just watch this film.
I actually wanted to touch on something you said when we were watching last week around Aragorn giving certain blades to the hobbits.
Yes.
And how he had potentially had foresight.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So it's not like I remember reading about this, and it was saying that, so on, for context, when they reach Weathertop, Aragorn, or Strider as he's known then, he's leading the hobbits to Rivendell. They decide to camp at Weathertop, or Amansul, as it's known, for the night. He's going to go get some food and just do a perimeter check, but he gives them each a dagger for him, but swords for the hobbits, given how small they are. And there was a note that he may have had foresight, which may have come from his Numenorean blood, because he ends up giving Pippin a sword from Gondor that he had with him, or like one of his daggers, and he ends up giving Merry a sword from Rohan that he got. These are swords that he had in his travels and that he brought with him. And I'm not sure if Frodo and Sam's swords were from any distant regions, but the fact that he gave those swords to Merry and Pippin, there's a theory that he may have had a slight bit of foresight. Whether that's from being raised by Elrond, who had foresight, or whether it's from his Numenorean blood, don't know. But it was a good little note. It sort of leads to this thing about how, I think J.R.R. Tolkien spoke about this, but a mystery that is unsolved or is not known can sometimes be better than the known. So a lot of the mysteries in Lord of the Rings are open-ended.
Open to interpretation.
Yeah, and it's perfectly fine as well. Like, we learn that Gandalf, Saruman, and Radagast were not the only wizards sent down. There were two others, but we just don't know what happened to them.
So it's just
interesting to say that there are things out there that even Tolkien didn't really know. Maybe he did, but it's fine. Like, it's okay to have a mystery open.
Opposite of the Star Wars universe, where everything has to be explained to the team.
Yeah,
and like everyone needs a backstory.
Yeah, exactly.
Some guy in the background in like a shot. Yeah, he has like a two-book backstory.
Yeah. Or bloody Harry Potter with Crimes of Grindelwald.
Yeah, where every character needs
every character needs
a stupid backstory.
Except that guy in the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, what happened to... Anyway, let's not get into
that. He died. We don't need to talk about that.
it's like, but the original Star Wars was that. It had that.
The original Star Wars did have that.
The open mystery. Yeah, and that's what this feels like, the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of mystery, people asking questions, and
But then, as subsequent stuff came out, everything. But the original, like, especially New Hope, is very much like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to ask a question, because I still have a question about this. Yep. So, at the end, when the Fellowship does get disbanded, so obviously Gandalf dies, supposedly dies, and then Boromir dies, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, they go to look for Pippin and Merry because they've been captured. Why do they just let Frodo and Sam leave?
Because Frodo doesn't want, he wants to do it by himself, because he feels like if he has anyone around him, they'll be drawn to the ring and they'll ruin it. So He's like, I have to do it by
myself. Yeah. And that's from his exchange with Boromir, I'm guessing.
No, it's with Galadriel. He's exchanged with Galadriel.
Yeah, because then, well, Galadriel warns him, right? And then...
But he already makes a decision there, and then Boromir
kind of.
It even goes as early as Gandalf, because Gandalf tells him, trust in yourself.
Yeah.
And it's just that kind of sense of, like, trust your instincts. He was trying to tell him to trust his instincts, but Frodo took it to be like, you know, just take the responsibility all on your own shoulders.
Yes.
To the point where even he was going to go solo without Sam. And Sam, forces I think himself. It was more credit to Sam to say, you know, I don't care, I'm coming with you.
Because of a promise he made to Gandalf.
Yeah.
So I have a theory about Sam. This someone may have already said this, and this may be completely untrue, mm-hmm. but is there like homosexual undertones with Sam and Frodo? This might be totally...
Doesn't he? Totally, he marries someone after they get back to the show.
I reckon until that part, I would say that they...
No, this was a massive discussion in the movies because until the movies were released, there was no discussion of this team because the books didn't make it seem like that.
Yeah.
The relationship dynamic that has to be understood, though, is that Sam was Frodo's gardener. So there's kind of a... So in Bag End, you know how we said that all the members were royalty except for the hobbits? Technically, Frodo was of royalty of the Hobbit town because Baggins.
Oh, he's like a wealthier.
He's one of the Hobbit. Wealthiest families, yeah, and yeah. and you know that Bag End is the biggest house in the Shire, right on top of the hill, right. So Samwise was a gardener who's considered like his station was one level below the Baggins, right. So the Gamgees were kind of the you know the gardeners, the workers are on the same. They're on the same level as the Proudfeet. That's how Tolkien describes. There was a bit of classism and that kind of stuff. Mm. So Sam always revered Frodo as like that master friend who he really wants to protect. That's why he calls him Mr. Frodo.
Yes.
Doesn't call him Frodo or Mr. Baggins.
Even in like the third movie, he's calling him Mr. Frodo, I think.
Yeah. There's that reverence.
Yeah.
So that reverence comes across like this this kind of... It's not a servitude. It's more so of a friendship that's born out of a need to say, you know what, I am someone who's going to be useful to you. I'm going to be a productive member of your team, and I'm going to help you directly. And I made a promise to you know Mr. Gandalf, and I'm going to help you. But I still think Sam loves Frodo.
I think they both love each other.
They love each other, but not all love.
How they love each other? Yeah,
like not all love has to be this kind of overtly erotic. No, form.
Yeah.
This one, like when I watched the film, I'm like, these two love each other so much. It's like respect of,
you can be friends. And
oh, yeah. I think they're more than friends. They're like brothers. They're like brothers. They actually kind of, they know what this is about. This is a really important task. But Sam admires Frodo and he loves his qualities and he wants to bring him back home alive.
Yeah.
Essentially. But at the same time, you can see Sam having this conflict with Rosie. Like he's too scared to ask Rosie out for a dance, and he's like, oh, maybe I'll have another rail.
If you just watch this movie, I reckon you would think that Sam is in love with Frodo because
is that the time we live in though? Because back then I never thought that, but maybe.
Well, just watching it now, I feel like Sam is in love with Frodo.
Yeah, yeah. If you watch it today, especially after like Stranger Things and how they're kind of trying to show that feeling of. Well, how does it feel like for someone to be completely isolated and not being able to show the unrequited love they have for their best friend? I absolutely understand. People watching it today will definitely feel that way. And you know what? I reckon it could be open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm not going to say that it wasn't that. I'm just saying that the way I saw it was this really nice brotherly love. The hilarious thing was Dom Monaghan, who plays Merry, played a prank on Elijah Wood during the media junket when he was interviewing it. And Dom pretended to be like a German interviewer and you couldn't see him. It was behind a video telecast. And he brought this question up in a German accent saying, is there a gay connotation? And you should watch that interview because Elijah would just completely burst out laughing and tells him, no. I mean, you know, Sam is married and also, you know, the actor who plays Sam and all that, we're all family men and we all have, it's like, it was a really interesting thing at the time to see how they addressed that issue or even the topic of it. Today, it'd be completely different. Much more respectful conversation.
I reckon it's open to interpretation. Yeah, definitely.
It's like the way Lurtz loves Saruman.
I think that's one way.
Yeah. 100%. Like, because Saruman is leading Lurtz on, and Sauron is leading Saruman on.
Yeah.
It's like that episode of How I Met Your Mother.
Love triangle, but it's just a line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's actually, there's a lot of wonderful bromances in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah,
that you can take to the end of it, like just one, like with Boromir and Merry and Pippin,
yeah,
and then later on with Pippin and Gandalf, and then just in general, Legolas and Aragorn, just fuck yeah, already, just get a room already. Their chemistry just keeps getting better and better.
Yeah,
so good.
But yeah, like to answer your question though, like so in the books, I'll say this though, in the books, the plan was never for all of the Fellowship to go to Mordor. It was for Frodo to go to Mordor. And Elrond literally chose everyone based on two things. One, convenience for where they were actually traveling after the Council of Elrond, and also to have one representative from the Free Peoples.
Yeah. Okay.
So he chooses Legolas Gimli. Boromir is going to Minas Tirith anyway. Aragorn's going to Minas Tirith. So, like, yeah, we'll journey along as well. And Gandalf accompanies because he wants to help Frodo along. So the plan was never for all of them to go Mordor.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
But shit goes down the hill when Gandalf falls down in Moria.
Yeah.
Aragorn has to take lead. And then after Merry and Pippin get taken, he literally makes a decision. He's like, look, I can't leave Merry and Pippin to get executed. So we're going to go. And Frodo's made his choice. So to be fair, Frodo's pretty old at this point. He's like 50 years old during the actual journey. So
ages in this universe are weird.
Very weird.
So how old is Gandalf? Like thousands of years?
Thousands.
2,000, 3,000 years
He travels. Old. He comes to thing in the third age.
So in terms of age, so Gandalf's oldest in fellowship. So Gandalf's then oldest, Legolas? Then Legolas.
Oh, well,
in terms of the fellowship, Gandalf, Legolas.
Yeah.
And then Aragorn. No, I think Aragorn. Aragorn's like 90.
Aragorn's 90 years old?
Yeah.
Oh my God, he holds up.
87?
87 and 2,000. So 85.
Wait, what do they say that guy?
He's a Numenorean. So the Numenorean men were blessed with long life because of the way they stood with a faction of the elves back in the old ages.
The Noldorian, I think, elves, yeah.
I can't remember the name of the elves, but they stood with the faction of the elves, and Fëanor blessed the Numenorean men with long life. Okay. So that blessing lasts through the generations.
Yeah.
But he's which like is why, one of the last of that bloodline. Like,
Like the rest are probably like out in Valinor or if they traveled out there.
But
or-
Boromir and Faramir, they're descended off that branch, but they don't have that Dunedain blood.
So Boromir would be like 30, wouldn't he?
Yeah, Boromir would be like 30 or 40, 30, 35.
Yeah. So is he the youngest, almost?
He might be, yeah.
Boromir is younger than the Hobbits?
Yeah, so Merry and Pippin are about, I think they're 10 years younger than Frodo, so 40 each. Because the thing about the books is that from Bilbo's party, when he turns 111, Frodo turns 33 at that party. And then it's 17 years from then before Frodo actually leaves the Shire. On his travels to go to Rivendell.
Yeah. So he's 50 we were commenting on this last week where it feels like it's like a week.
Where Gandalf leaves the Shire, goes to Minas Tirith, checks out the documents on the ring, verifies what it is. Then he rides up to the boundary of Mordor to see what's going on. Yeah. And he rides back and it's like-
He comes back to the Shire a fair bit though in the books. Like it's literally 3 years, does his thing, comes back to the Shire over and again over the period of like, I'd say 2 years, I think, maybe 9 months. And then he goes for another 9 years out. And then does all that stuff with Aragorn and Gollum and stuff, then comes back. So a lot of stuff happens. But yeah, basically, I think Boromir is actually the youngest out of
and
that
Gimli
entire
Gimli would be older than the Hobbits?
Gimli. What is Gimli?
Actually, Gimli could be the youngest.
No. I think Gimli is four. Oh, maybe.
Because when the Hobbit happens, Gloin, Gimli's father, just gives, he announces he has a baby boy. So I'm pretty sure Gimli's the youngest.
Maybe. You might be right.
Like, I think he's like in his 20s by the time he's born. But he already has a full beard and he looks like he's middle-aged. But the thing about like the whole idea about the Hobbits being like 50 years old but still middle-aged is that they live such wonderful, stress-free lives with plenty
That's
of food
so,
and full of nature. So it's like, well, yeah, they live to be a long age. But they're also only like modeled off these mythical creatures that we see in European folklore, like leprechauns or things like – they're only 4 feet tall. They're not really noticeable. If they're walking around the – nature, you'll do a double take. Thing. Was that a person I just saw? So that's why they were chosen to be the ones to actually sneak in and destroy the ring. And I think, I'm not sure, you can maybe clarify this, Bhargav, that Elrond secretly kind of knew that if Frodo was going to do it, he wasn't going to come back alive. That he was going to die doing this because it's such a, it requires so much stealth. And the whole idea was to do it stealthily because you know, the Eye of Sauron, even though in the books it wasn't a fiery ball of you know, consciousness, it's that thing that Sauron can see you if you are, you know, if you have an army and you just walk up to the Black Gate saying, I'm going to destroy the ring, I have it here. He's not only going to bring the force to get you, but he's going to see you all the way before you leave your castle. So it's like, that's why whenever someone says, why couldn't they just use the eagles? to fly into Mordor and just dive bomb into it and, like, you know, plant it off? I get this question all the time from fans, and it's like that would have meant that Sauron would have seen this from, like, 10,000 steps away.
So he had to get close enough to be able to do that, essentially.
Well, even if you got close enough, like, let's say you pass the mountain ranges of Mordor and you had an eagle mount and you got Frodo in the claws on his crane or something, whatever, and you flew the eagle straight towards the mountain, the idea was that at that point itself, there were Nazgul on fell beasts with wings who could protect the, you know, any aerial assaults.
Yeah, so even then it would have
been. It was like, it's like there is the will of the ring is connected to the holder and is also Sauron's will. So if you're doing something, pretty much it's like Sauron kind of knows you're coming. Yeah. But if you do it, if the only the only creature that could resist was a hobbit.
The most unlikely of
Yeah, and it's like if you're sneaking around with the ring, it's like it's really hard to detect it. So
and not only like the actual getting to the place, but the emotional toll and the mental toll of actually carrying the ring for that long.
We see what happens to Frodo towards the end of that. Just devastating.
Just to correct, Gimli's 139 in the books.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go.
So he's a lot older. Peregrine is the youngest. So Pippin is 28.
Pippin.
Merry is 36. Boromir is 40 in the books when he leaves. Yeah. Gimli's 139. Because I think there was something about dwarves having longer lifespans. I think they live between 200 to 300 years. Legolas is just very old. No one really knows how old. Aragorn, 87. Gandalf, about 2,000 years. And then Samwise is about 38.
Okay.
And Frodo is 50, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Makes sense, yeah.
A bit of an age gap between Frodo and Sam. Don't know if we can...
12 years. Yeah,
it's all right. It's not bad.
Yeah.
What's that formula? Half your age plus
seven. So 25 plus 7, 32.
Hey, he's just 1 year off.
Close enough.
Close enough to date, though.
He's 6 years off. He's 38.
Yeah.
No, it's good. If he's older, it's fine. It's only if it's younger, it's dodgy.
Dodgy either way for my eyes.
What about Lurtz and Saruman?
Lurtz and Saruman. Lurtz is
5 minutes old.
Saruman's like 2,000 something years old. Let's not go there.
Let's do the formula.
All right. So anything else? I had some trivia that we can go through before we conclude.
I mean, if we want to finish off characters, Legolas, Gimli, and then the Hobbits.
Just Merry, Pippin.
Merry and Pippin. There's not much to really say. Like,
too much in this one.
In this one, there's not as much to talk about for them. Like,
they're more comedic relief in this.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're good support characters as well.
Yeah.
Pippin with the mage killer sister after Moria. Killing Gandalf.
Yeah. Well, actually, one thing about Moria. So, in the books, Gandalf wants to go to Moria, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this, he's very reluctant and they're forced to go to Moria.
Yeah. It's a lot more. In the books, he's a lot more like open to the idea of going through Moria because I don't think he's. The thing about the movie does this actually pretty well. It's that Gandalf, he knows a lot of stuff, but it's like a distant memory for him.
Yeah.
So it's like every time, even the Balrog comes up, he's like, I know what this is, but he's trying to figure out, like trying to remember what he knows about it.
And even the password to get into the lines as well.
Exactly,
That was him in the end.
It's like everything is a distant memory for him. And in the books, it's made clear that, from what I remember, that the sacking of Moria had not yet reached his ears. Whereas in this, it's kind of like, he almost kind of knows.
He knew it.
He kind of like hints that he knows.
Something bad happened in the mines,
So... Yeah, it's not the first course of action, but he's a lot more open to the idea than he is in the movies.
And another thing, so I always, like, whenever they're getting chased or they're doing something, some reason Frodo always ends up last.
Slow.
And I don't know, I think there might be a reason for it. I think maybe the ring just forces him. Like, they talk about the ring as it's not an object, it's an entity. They always say the ring.
It's an entity,
ring made him do this, or the ring. So it's got some sort of power associated with it.
I mean, it has properties to kind of change size, to slip off your finger if you're in the water, like you do a Isildur and he got killed because of it. I'm thinking it can even get heavier and lighter.
Yeah.
Let's say if you're being chased by an enemy, it might get heavier to try and drag you back.
Yeah.
To try and get you caught because then you would go back to
Sauron. That's my favorite scene in the movie.
The far when Isildur dies.
When Isildur gets jacked by a bunch of random orcs.
Some random dude just jumps him.
And then he decides to go for a swim.
It's like he got mugged on a New York street. That's what happens.
He's on his way to the Bronx.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's... Was there anything else on
characters?
Yeah, characters-wise, I think we've covered...
Characters-wise,
we can talk about Saruman, obviously.
Talk about villains, yeah.
He's bad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Played by Christopher Lee, who... like we were talking just on the...
Yes, so that. He's...
very, very talented.
One of the biggest Lord of the Rings fans. So he read the book every year till he died. And also he is the only one that has met J.R.R. Tolkien out of the cast members.
And I think when he initially was auditioning, he was auditioning for the role of Gandalf because he thought he'd play a really good Gandalf. And I think Peter Jackson said that Christopher Lee has an amazing booming voice. And that he wanted to use that for Saruman. And he actually, like initially Christopher Lee was a little bit disappointed, but he loved stepping into that role. And I think he took that on really, really well. There's a wonderful war story that Christopher Lee shares that's appropriate for Return of the King.
Okay.
Putting a page in that, or we'll talk about it once we do Return of the King.
But he doesn't do as much in this movie as well. He does more in the following movie.
Yeah.
So
And we'll talk about it in the next couple of movies, but I'm pretty sure in the theatrical version, you don't actually see him die?
No.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
You don't know what happens to him. He's just like, Sauron's power.
He just stays in the tower.
I think you just see Isengard fall, but you don't see what happens to him.
You just see Treebeard going, the filth of Saruman is washing away. All right, that's that.
Yeah, but like, in the extended, he's definitely dead. You see him.
It's a bit of courage.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
You see the dam break in the theatrical. You see the dam break.
That's two towers. It's two towers.
You see
all that happening.
Yeah.
He gets his chiropractic treatment in Return of the King.
We'll talk about that.
I don't know, I'm trying to think about in the books. I remember the reason he turns evil is done somewhat well in the movies. I remember in the books it was mentioned that his task set by the Maiar, the reason he was sent down was to study Sauron and to study I don't want to say dark arts, but just study the dark arts. Yeah. And he starts to admire it. And that's
he gets lured.
That's the start of the fall. Yeah.
Yeah. He starts to logically list saying, well, he's the most powerful entity left in the world. I want this. I should align with him.
Yeah.
He just makes a logical thing. He's like, that's.
Oh, I don't know if it goes from that, but it goes from studying Sauron's,
following it.
Yeah. Following it to realizing that it's actually quite beautiful in his words.
Mm.
And then starting to,
it's kind of like Voldemort.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really wanting alerts. And then he makes it.
Well, a bit of trivia on this, actually, and we've already mentioned Star Wars, but Christopher Lee played a similar role in the Star Wars prequels, in which he played Count Dooku, who was a Jedi who turned to the dark side, and he's an apprentice to Darth Sidious. So,
basically the same role.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The question is, does he ask anyone if they know where the history of
I don't think you ask anyone.
The history of the Sith.
You know where the history of the Sith is.
No, the history of orcs.
Unfortunately, it doesn't ask anyone about history. So this role trumps Count Dooku.
This is why Attack of the Clones failed.
Okay, no, he does. Count Dooku trains in Clone Wars. He trains Darth Maul's brother.
And, I know who he is.
Oh, Lurtz. Yeah.
No. He's basically Lurtz. He's this big, like...
He's a yellow dude.
Yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. And, there's a moment like that. It's like, do you know what the rule of the Sith is? And he's like, it's rule two. He actually does this.
But, that guy's not as good as Lurtz, though. He's yellow. He's cool. But Lurtz is a whole new level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lurtz is sexy.
Yeah.
Well, what other villains are there? It's pretty much just... In this, it's actually just... Saruman.
It's literally just Lurtz.
Saruman. The Balrog, you could say, is a villain. Balrog, the Ringwraiths, of course.
Yes.
The
Nazgul.
Nazgul.
We didn't talk about that.
It's a big one, yeah.
Yeah. They, obviously, in the first half of this movie, they play a pretty prominent role. The scene they have with Aragorn where he fights them, the way that scene happens is funny as well. It's not meant to be funny, but they have a fire and basically lures them in. And
Oh, by the way, you know that area where they're cooking sausages and having the fire? That's not a set. That was shot on the mountainside in North New Zealand. You know that the whole structure of the mountain where Aragorn looks and says, I'm on Saul. The only thing that's not real is that the very top of the mountain where they've added in a little bit of the structure, they film everything on that mountain. And then when they do at the top itself, that's the studio. When they actually do the Ringwraiths fighting the hobbits, that's in the studio.
Yeah.
So it's really the location... Locations were amazing in this film. I can't speak more highly about that.
Yeah.
It's a good scene.
Oh yeah.
Well, now that you mentioned that, it's a real location. The lighting that they have in that scene is, considering it's a real location, it's amazing. It's amazing. That, how they did that.
Yeah. That whole nighttime. I think a lot of nighttime shots are more convincing for CGI to play a part in when they do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah. That's a quality of this movie, is that they do most of the CGI at night, which makes it less noticeable.
Yeah. Age is much better. Age is much better.
If you see daytime CGI from that era, it's terrible.
Yeah. I mean, what's a movie that came out in 2001?
Harry Potter.
Yeah. And that, I saw that recently. It doesn't look as good.
Spider-Man
was 2002. So, 2002? Yeah. So circa same as sort of Two Towers.
Yeah.
Scene in Harry Potter does not hold up. Yeah.
A lot of it doesn't. You know when they walk into Diagon Alley and the bricks kind of.
You can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The moment you upscale some of those movies to 4K, you can really tell. But this one.
Yeah.
It still holds up.
They hide the CGI in the dark. They use real sets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good costuming and.
Yeah.
Makeup, yeah,
very like analog style filmography,
really old school, and the miniatures, or the biggages they used to call it, because the miniatures were so big in this film, they used to call them biggages. As I think that's the most monumental device they use in this film, because it ages flawlessly. Like there's that one shot when they're going down the river and they approach the Argonath, which is two statues of the Numenorean kings, and they actually made 10-foot-tall styrofoam statues for that. So they use the miniature and they film the reference shots. And then when they put it in the film, it looks real. It looks like it's a giant mountainside statue. And it's like there's a certain realism to something that's actually physically there, even if it's like not to scale. The art, for a certain period of time, that art was lost. People stopped doing that. They just went straight CGI. Graphics sucked between the 2005 to 2009. It was terrible. CGI was like a CGI dark ages. People stopped doing that. You go back and watch Lord of the Rings now, it's just like that stuff is really, it looks, the detail is still amazing.
I think just the attention to detail in this trilogy is just astounding. I don't think we've seen anything like it since then.
Yeah.
So
the MCU.
Yeah.
MCU is good.
I think CGI-wise, we can talk about this in another episode, but MCU, I think.
Well, the CGI isn't that good in the MCU.
I think it was better when they started than it is now.
Yeah, it gets worse as it goes on.
So, we'll have to see how those MCU movies stack up in 20 years' time. I don't think they'll stack up that well.
I think they'll be good story-wise,
but yeah.
You know, I suppose people aren't buying 4K Blu-rays anymore. They're streaming.
Yeah.
And streaming really reduces the quality of what you see.
All right. Anything else? We can run through a bit of trivia.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So, what do you think the body count was in this movie?
Oh, people who died?
Yeah.
Does the orcs count?
Yeah.
Everything.
Uruk-hai orcs.
Including Gandalf.
So, someone's actually...
1,224.
No.
Oh, you got to count all the prologue. Because
you got to count the guys at the start.
Yeah, the prologue scenes, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Actually, this seems a little low. When you take
it's the starts, it's got to be in the thousands.
Yeah, so it's not in the thousands. So someone's done it. This is on IMDb official.
I'll guess 141.
I guess. Oh, okay, shit.
It's 118, apparently.
Okay, that sounds like non-prologue.
Non-prologue. Yeah.
Or non-flashbacky.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
How many Uruk-hai were there? Well, I guess they don't really kill that many of them, right?
They wouldn't have counted the ones at the start. They kill so many. Yeah.
Yeah. At one time we see at least 30 or 40 on the screen. There must have been like 50 to 70 Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
In that first wave.
Yeah. So they've done it for every movie. So we'll see what happens in I'm pretty sure Return of the King is.
It's going to be thousands.
Pretty big. Yeah.
Two Towers will be 10,000.
Helm's Deep. Yeah, there's lots of
that. So we've talked about how they filmed it with the different heights. So in some of the scenes, Ian McKellen would stand really close to the camera, so it looks like he's tall.
Yeah,
and then the hobbits would stand further back.
The scene in the cart when Frodo jumps in the cart.
It's a little kid that
jumps. Oh no, it's Elijah Wood, but the cart isn't a whole structure. Like the camera's on the diagonal. Ian McKellen's sitting up front, and then the cart is like cut in half, move back, move right. And Elijah Wood is sitting further away, but it looks like they're sitting right next to each other on the same cart. So, like, the sets were constructed with an angle in mind and, like, angle projection. So, really old school tricks that Peter Jackson learned from doing his filmmaking. And it doesn't look out of place. It looks pretty legit. They did get miniatures as well. They did get scale doubles as yeah. well. And there's
miniatures.
Yeah, yeah.
Miniature people.
Dwarves. Kieran Sharp was the one they got for Frodo. And he went on to do a lot of stuff for Warner Brothers afterwards.
He's the Oompa Loompa.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's the Oompa Loompa in Charlie and Chocolate Factory. Yeah. Another guy called BK, who was another Indian fellow, but two Indian guys, a Thai woman, and a 12-year-old kid to play Pippin.
Did you know that Peter Jackson gave one of the rings used in the movies to Elijah Wood and Andy Serkis as a gift when the shoot finished? They both thought that they had the only one.
I heard about this.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
He didn't tell that there were two made.
Wow.
I bet there was a third that was made, but hidden in secret.
he probably has it.
Probably his cock ring.
Despite playing.
I was about to say. I was going to say, it's probably on his dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One ring to rule.
This is. Now I'm going to have to edit that out.
No. Edit out everything else. Keep only that part.
Keep that. Yeah.
That's our review.
Yeah, that'll be our reel that goes out on Instagram.
Yeah. Red band trailer.
I'll just have to find relevant footage. That's all.
I can get you something.
All right. Despite playing the dwarf, John Rhys-Davies is the tallest actor of all the members in the Fellowship. So he's 6'1".
Okay. Oh, no tallest. Way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't know?
I didn't know he was the tallest.
Tall as hell, yeah.
Taller than Ian McKellen.
Yeah, he's tall as crap.
Yeah. Is Ian McKellen actually
tall? He's not actually that tall.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of tricks played to make him look really tall.
He's got a giant. Yeah.
Because he always seems to, like, even when he's Magneto, he looks like he's really tall, but I don't think he's actually that tall. Originally, the narration at the prologue was to be spoken by Elijah Wood. And then it was going to be Ian McKellen, but then they chose Cate Blanchett because she would have her character would have been there at that time.
Yeah,
she was.
Yeah.
And Gandalf, they thought it wouldn't have been as relevant if it was Gandalf saying it. And obviously, Frodo saying it wouldn't have really made much sense. Yeah,
should have had Lert saying it.
I actually thought he didn't know how to talk, but. He
does
know.
Have a dog?
No, he knows that. He says Saruman.
He says find the halfling and then when he's like shouting.
Whom do you serve?
So he does know how to talk.
Fair enough.
Yeah. He's got a nice vocabulary.
Limited, but good. Yeah. It serves its purpose.
Very thorough.
Hobbiton was made a year before production began to make it look like it was natural, lived in, and complete with a real vegetable patch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Greens Department regulated the length of the grass by having sheep eat it.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very
lots
lifelike.
Of sheep in New Zealand.
Yeah. Well,
have you guys, who's been up to Hobbiton?
We have not been.
No, we haven't.
Yeah.
Oh, you should see it. It's so cool.
To go 2 years ago, actually, but
Yeah. It was only there after they rehabilitated for The Hobbit, but it's so good. I remember when we were watching the film, again, I was just like, everything you're seeing right now is real. The only thing that's not real is that one tree above Bag End, which is a like synthetic tree. And they actually had to make individual leaves for that tree and stick it on that tree.
They sewed on each leaf.
Sewed on each leaf. Yeah. And it was just like everything else is like you stand on that hill, you can actually see the whole like Shire as they rebuilt it.
Yeah.
Just so cool.
That's what I had in terms of trivia. There's literally thousands and thousands of pieces of trivia on this movie.
Yeah.
So go to IMDb. If you're really bored, you can spend a day reading through the trivia about this movie.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of it will be on Lerts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's one on Lerts about him not being in the books. So,
yeah. But the stuntman who plays him comes back for Two Towers and he comes back for Return of the King. He plays pretty important.
We got to spot this character in both those movies.
Okay.
Now.
He's going to be our protagonist for the podcast series.
It'll be like, where's Wally? But it's where's Lerts?
Okay. Anything to conclude with? We're obviously going to be – we'll watch Two Towers soon
when
we get a chance and we'll review that pretty soon. So before the end of Rings of Power, I think they're doing weekly episode releases, right? Yeah, we'll have all of the trilogy out and then we'll also review Rings of Power once that's done. All right, so if people want to get in touch with us about their thoughts on Fellowship, how they go about it.
We're on all platforms at Cognitive Recalibration, or you can email us at cognitiverecalibrationpodcast@gmail.com.
We are actually posting reasonably regularly now on Instagram Instagram and TikTok. So we've started posting on TikTok so you can watch snippets of our reviews. There's two a week now that we're posting. So if you can't stand listening to us for an hour, you can watch a reel of us for a minute. And if you want to support the podcast, you can do so by giving us a review on iTunes or Spotify. So Spotify is just a rating out of 5 stars. In iTunes, you can actually write a review as well. So that makes us more discoverable on search engines if we do get more reviews. Thanks to both of you guys.
Thanks for having us on. Welcome. This has been a long time coming. We really wanted to come and talk about this series, which is a masterpiece in every way.
Yes. If you're up for it, we'll get you back for Two Towers and Return of the King as well. And Rings of Power as well. Why not? Let's do all of them.
Let's do one straight through. Yeah.
So
no, I'm one and done.
One and done. Okay.
For life.
Well, we were going to get you on for Black Adam, actually, because you usually come on for our DC.
Okay, so two and
done. Yeah.
Does he come for our DC?
Yeah, he came. You've done Shazam.
Oh, Shazam.
Wonder Woman.
Shazam.
Wonder Woman 84.
That was the POS.
Oh, 1984. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Not a good movie.
Anyway, different franchise. So anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We could have gone more in depth on this. We could just keep talking about this movie, but
there's hours and hours of stuff online if you want more in depth stuff.
Yes. Appendices, yes. Reddit posts. Just go to Movie Detail subreddit and search for Lord of the Rings. It's just page after page after
There'll
page.
There'll be
page.
More than we could ever talk about.
Yeah.
A lot of fanfic about Lurtz and Saruman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not by me.
That's a Wattpad.
But I will advertise it.
All right. So hope you enjoyed the episode. Hope you're all staying safe. And catch our next episode on Two Towers very soon. See you later.
Catch you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.